Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which six amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another Books with Hooks segment. This is one of our experimental ones in which we are having the very brave author on the call with us so that we can discuss the query letter and opening pages with them so that they have an opportunity to answer our questions and ask questions of their own. So it's my pleasure today to welcome our guest author, Emma, who is going to kick us off by reading her query letter. Take it away, Emma.
Thank you, Bianca. Dear Ms. Waters, I am seeking representation for my debut novel, Cuckoo Bees, complete at 74,000 words. Cuckoo Bees is a multi-POV psychological thriller that melds the dysfunctional twin dynamics of Rose Carlyle's The Girl in the Mirror with the interrogation room tension of Tana French's The Secret Place. You mentioned on your podcast that you enjoy stories featuring sisters, so I hope that my book will be of interest to you. Devoted mother, social parasite, murderer. Two out of three describe Lena Jansen, whose world has just been shattered by the death of her young son. Making matters worse, Lena's identical twin sister, Jo Bailey, is apparently to blame. Jo killed him, then took her own life. Or at least, that's what Lena claims. Cuckoo Bees untangles the snarl of deception surrounding the crime, flipping between the sisters' twisted history and the present homicide investigation. The detectives assigned to the case are suspicious of Lena. When they start digging, they uncover holes in her story and uncomfortable truths about her past. But as Lena dissembles and deflects her way through the interrogations, the detectives find themselves outmaneuvered at almost every turn. Lena's playing the long game, and she only ever plays to win. I am a research lawyer specializing in family and refugee law, and I have two nonfiction publication credits for legal writing, titles redacted. I live in Toronto, where I am working on my second novel and perfecting my homemade pasta. I have included the first five pages of Cuckoo Bees for your review. Thank you for your time and consideration. Sincerely, Emma, she, her.
Awesome. Emma, thank you so much for that. Right, Carly, since the query letter was directed at you, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. Deep breath, Carly. I thought this was so good. You did such a good job. you really just like followed the structure, executed it perfectly with the three paragraphs. For me, I mean, oh man, I have to like catch my breath. I'm so excited. My heart's like boom, 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 boom. Okay, so deep breath. Okay, so the question I have is the title. I'm like, okay, I don't know what's going on here, but it's okay. I don't need to know everything about the title, but it's like a little bit of question mark, and that's okay. The comps are great. Obviously, you mentioned that you listen on the podcast, so we have like a little bit of that personalization connection. This is one of those queries, and this is like what happens in my head when I'm reading a lot of queries. Normally, as we've talked about on the podcast before, like I'm reading usually dozens, if not like 100 queries at a time. So I'm often like skimming for keywords, or I'm like trying to figure out like what exactly is going to draw me to this. So with this one, I really love that you had that like staccato opening of like devoted mother, social parasite, murderer, you know what I mean? Like you hit kind of the notes on like if somebody was pulling for keywords like me when I'm reading 100 queries at 8 p.m. on a Tuesday night, you really like hit all of those like hard hitting words and kind of very dramatic opening. So I thought that was great. As somebody who has young children, I have two young boys, the like the young son thing, like some agents can't read about dangerous things happening with like Cece's thing is like pets. She can't handle hearing or reading about dead animals or animals in danger or crisis. As a mom of two young boys, sometimes I have a hard time with things about young children in danger. So it's, but I can separate my life from my agent brain. So I'm not one of those agents that necessarily has a problem separating those two things. I'm usually okay with that. So that was fine for me, but it could be a red flag for other agents who might also have small children. And so when I got to the point in the query about the making matters worse, Lena's identical twin sister, Jo Bailey, is apparently to blame. Jo killed them and took her own life. After that, you kind of hooked me at that point. Like you've kind of like done the job that the query letter is supposed to do. And after that point, I'm kind of just like skimming in terms of like, okay, what happens next? But in terms of the job a query is supposed to do, a query is supposed to hook agents and make them request pages. So you did everything that a query has to do. And then you left off with some really extra juicy bits in the end about the, is it Lena that is leading us on the whole time? Really, I don't have anything to kind of critique because I think you did like such a wonderful, wonderful job. And then with the last paragraph, you know, you have the little bio in terms of your history, perfecting your homemade pasta, super adorable. So yeah, all in all, I really honestly think it's a perfect query. And I'm talking really fast because I'm just so excited. It's so good.
Awesome. Awesome, Carly. Thank you. Emma, we were going to hear from Cece as well. And then after that, you can comment and maybe ask questions, etc. But it's great that Emma lives in Toronto and so do Cece and I. So we're around for some of that homemade pasta, just saying. Okay, Cece, what would you like to say about that query letter?
I mean, first of all, I want the pasta. So again, I just want to echo everything Carly said. This is really good. Definitely hooked me. This is an amazing, amazing query. I don't think you're going to need any notes because I have a feeling that you will be matched with an agent soon. But again, the point of the podcast is to give notes. I would use quotation marks in the comp titles and I would edit the following line, or at least that's what Lena claims. And then I'm not going to say it perfectly, but just to give you the idea, at least that's what Lena claims when the homicide investigation is open, because you ended up burying the fact that there was a homicide investigation in the following sentence, which again, as you could tell by Carly's reaction, doesn't actually matter, but it's in my opinion, that would actually elevate the stakes, right? Bring the fact that there is a homicide investigation to the forefront of the story. Some stories, they do take place in like I'm thinking of Leanne Moriarty's Big Little Lies. Like they do have a lot of scenes where they're investigating things, or that TV show, The Affair, but it isn't quite clear that there is a homicide investigation because the death hasn't been ruled a homicide yet. And so in your case, if it has, that actually means even more tension, right? So something to think about. I actually had a question when I read this, which I'll ask because this is the amazing thing about what we're doing here. You say multi-POV. Whose POV do we get? Because is it just the sisters? Because that'd be dual. So you didn't say dual. So who else?
So I have a less than straightforward answer to a very straightforward question,
okay,
which is that part of the mystery is whether one or both twins are narrated. I can say that primarily it's a story told in the first person from the perspective of Lena, our protagonist. And it's for the reader to decide if and or when Jo chimes in. In addition, there are some third-person chapters to explore the perspectives, primarily of the detectives.
And these chapters, are they like shorter chapters, like with the Q&A, or are they like chapters where we really dig deep into the interiority of the detectives?
They're shorter chapters, but there is some digging into who are they, what are what are they getting from all that's kind of unfolding in front
of them? Yeah, like way more than a transcript, right? With the Q&A, I actually go into their heads.
Absolutely. It's third person close for the detectives.
Because when I saw this query, and then when I scrolled down and I was like, let's just see what point of view, and I skipped chapter one because it's two lines. Not skipped as in I didn't read it, skipped as in I didn't count it for the purposes of my question. My theory, and we can cut this if you want us to, my theory is it wasn't actually Lena who was talking to us, right, in the first person, it was Joe. She was Joe pretending to be Lena. And if that's what you want the reader to think, I think you're on the right track. But if that's not what you want the reader to think, like, let's say that's not the case and that's just a red herring. So people like me go, it's not actually Lena. It's Joe who's being, you know, interrogated. Interrogated is the wrong word because she's not a suspect officially. But then I would add something to throw people off the tracks if that's not what you want them to think. But I feel like I'm talking about the pages, so I'll stop now.
Yeah, you've dived in. You've dived right the hell in. Okay, let's pull it back again. So Emma, what response do you have to that? What questions do you have for Carly and Cece based on, you know, their feedback to your query letter?
Well, I'm so thrilled that you enjoyed it and so thrilled that you're doing this. On this podcast, I would just say, has changed substantially the kind of query letter that I've been constructing. So the number of edits that this podcast allowed me to make was pretty huge. I would say, Cece, thank you for the comments on kind of highlighting this is a homicide investigation, stakes are higher, tension's there. And then actually you kind of went right to it, which was, I thought that they would have questions about POV. And so as long as I'm not misrepresenting it by describing it as multi-POV, then that's good. But it is, you've kind of targeted exactly what I was concerned about, which is that going to be confusing? So that's something great for me to think about.
So I wasn't confused. I was curious. That's totally fine. In fact, it's a good thing, right? Like curiosity, yay. Confusion, nay.
Yeah. And trying to write a query letter for a multi-POV novel is hard. It's so hard. It's the hardest type of query letter that you can write. So the fact that you just simplified it for yourself by not explaining all the POVs, actually you did yourself a favor because you made this easier to consume while still making it interesting. So you did your job. You did your job.
Wonderful. Any other questions, Emma?
Not that I can think of right now.
Okay, that's fine. You've got time to process. All right. So now we're going to ask Emma just to give an overview for the listeners as to what are in her first five pages so that as we discuss it, you'll understand exactly what it is we're speaking about. So Emma, give us a bit of a synopsis there.
Absolutely. So the book opens in the present with a very short snippet. I didn't wake up today planning to kill two people. One, yes, but not two. It was never supposed to end like this. The next chapter, still in the present, finds us at a police station in an interrogation room. We meet Lena Jansen, who's giving us a first-person account of being interviewed by two homicide detectives, Detective Anthony Garcia and Detective Britta Algren. We learn that Lena's toddler, Jack, is dead, and it appears that Lena's sister, Jo, was babysitting for him when he died. Lena is stunned, struggling to answer the detective's questions about her arrangements for Jack's care, about her whereabouts that afternoon, but she's also being slightly evasive about her activities earlier that day. And I would say that's pretty much what's going on in the first five pages.
Awesome. Thanks, Emma. All right, Carly, let's start with you again. What was your take on the pages?
Okay, so I really, really was just so curious. I mean, as Cece was saying, it matters that we are dancing between who this is in terms of like which sister it is. It matters and it doesn't, right? It matters because ultimately that's the thread of the story and that's what we're kind of here to figure out. But it doesn't matter in the sense that, again, like Cece said, the curiosity is there, right? Like the book is doing its job. So it's not that you have to explain to it. Like it's not your job as the author to tell us which sister this is, right? Like you're planting all the seeds in such a way that some readers are going to think like, oh, I have this all figured out. And then other readers are going to think like, I don't know where this is going. So in terms of that kind of internal confusion about what sister this might be is actually really interesting. And one of those threads, I think that that's really going to pull us all along. In terms of like on a line by line level here, there was a couple things where the character is very in tune with how they're feeling and what they're touching and all of their senses and everything like that. Like they're talking about being cold and then the blanket and then the mug is hot and it's burning the fingers. I would try to not like double down, because sometimes you kind of explain it twice. You say the mug is so hot, it feels like it's burning my fingers. And then you say this pain provides a point of focus. I squeeze it harder. Like just things like that, where it almost feels like you're doubling down. So just try to just only say that type of thing once. You also say just above that, I feel numb, cold, like my insides might never fully defrost. And so you're kind of repeating yourself, like numb, cold, and also your insides might never fully, but kind of the same thing, right? So again, you kind of just like double down. So whatever you can, just like strike through and just try to narrow down on like exactly that feeling instead of saying it twice. And yeah, like there was on that first page, again, this comes down to you doing your job right. But on the first page, I was confused about how distant the person was feeling on the page, right? It doesn't open with a mom just like screaming on the top of her lungs, being like, my child's dead, right? Like it's this like very numb woman just like sitting here trying to figure out what's going on. And so again, you don't need to have the mom screaming at the top of her head, but it makes me think, oh, why isn't this mom screaming at the top of her head? Why is she numb? Why isn't she rattling the doors trying to get out? You know what I mean? Like, where is that emotionality? And you tuck it away in a way that you're describing it as numb, but numb can also mean effusive, or numb can also mean she wasn't there for the murder. You know, like all of these things that we don't actually know and can't quite figure out. So yeah, so all of that to say, you're doing your job right. It's compelling. It's a page turner. And I definitely want to figure out what's happening next. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how the head hopping goes, because you have like chapter one now and that short line, and then chapter two now. And then like, are you going to eventually tell us who's speaking? When are we moving into the past? Just exactly how much hopping we're going to do. And whenever I work on a client project like this, it's really hard to critique the opening until I've read the whole thing, right? Like I need to kind of like see this whole picture, see the whole book, and then we kind of go back and make sure the ending, or the beginning, sorry, matches up to exactly where we need it to be. So all of this to say, it's a really brilliant opening. And in terms of me having to critique it, I can't wait to read the full thing. And then I can kind of go back and help you with the beginning.
That's awesome. Awesome feedback, Carly. Thank you. Right. I feel like we would have had a bit of a Shark Tank moment if Emma had directed the query to both Cece and Carly. But because it was just to Carly, I feel like Cece isn't quite going to do her Shark Tank fighting. Or are you still going to try, Cece?
Not fair to do it, because I have to respect the rules of the game. But no, seriously, I would be like getting on a train to Carly's and picketing outside her house. Let me have Emma, which would probably make it sound like you're in a hostage situation. But hey, no, these Peters are really good, Emma. I hope you're very proud of them, because it's just the quality is outstanding. I always say, like, people could give notes. Like I could get a best-selling published book and still give notes on that book, because that's, you know, you can always find something to share with someone. So of course I have things to tell you, but like, I was curious. Number one job with the query letter, with the first five pages, with the first chapter really, is to keep me wanting to find out what happened and what will happen, right? Like this, it is an important distinction. It can't just be, how do we get here? It has to be, what's going to happen next, with specificity. And that's exactly what's going through my head, right? Like I have theories, like I share. Like I don't think that we are in Lena's head. I think we're in Joe's head. I think Joe's pretending to be Lena. But does it matter? No, because whether that's true or not, A, I want to read to find out. And also B, you got me theorizing. So whether I'm completely off and I'm going to be corrected, or whether I'm right and I'm going to be satisfied, it's still equally compelling. I also think that, to lean in on what Carly said, there was a bit of repetition with sensations. The whooshing in the ear is something you mentioned a few times, heartbeat, feeling numb and cold. The impression I got is that you wove this in after writing like the dialogue or the interiority. I think that it's something that you can compress. Like these five pages, I think they can be two. I think you can convey the dialogue with a bit more of like condensing it. I don't think we need like the back and forth quite so much. I'm not saying like cut it all out, because it's important for us to see what kind of word choice she's going with and everything. It's also important that we don't hear it in her head, because we don't know who's actually talking, but it's excellent. One thing that I really think that you should, so suggestions, right? Like on page 3, but remember there's the query before. She is very observant. Like Detective Garcia is playing good cop, right? Like whether he's actually a good cop or not, I don't know. But Detective Algren is not looking at her, right? Like, and Detective Algren, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, is a woman. So I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if she's paying more attention, whether she's Joe or Lena, to this woman detective and not the man detective, because it's harder to trick women. And I love that. And so that's something that you don't have to change in these first 5 pages, but I feel like leaning into that, leaning into the fact that maybe you're doing it already, but I kept hoping you would. I also don't think you need the italics, like for the thoughts. We're in first person. We don't need it. Unless there's something about like a red herring, which I didn't catch, but I don't think you need it. It's not getting in the way. Just don't think you need it. I also have to talk about how wonderful this detail, a few details are. Like, as an example, it's funny how our minds fix on irrelevant details in a crisis. The spoiled steaks are entirely beside the point. But now that I've thought about it, I can't stop imagining the smell of rotting meat that will greet me when I return to the house. First of all, she didn't say home. She said the house, which is telling. And second of all, that is exactly what happens. Like when you're in a crisis, especially in the aftermath, right? Like it already happened. You're thinking about the smallest things. And I think it's a way our mind protects us, right? Like we can't think about the big picture. And so we focus on this tiny, tiny thing and we spiral. So yeah, I again, big note is that I would compress. I think you can cut back on a few things and lean in, whether in these first five pages or in the future, because I was curious. I was also curious about things that weren't on the page, but that were made clear in the query letter and that are just obvious. Things like, what twisted history? Like, they have a twisted history. I want to know what it is. So loved this, like, amazing. Good job. Congratulations. I am both happy that you directed this at Carly because Carly's the best, but I'm also very upset because, yeah, I was looking forward to a battle of the agents.
Yeah, no, it's so good. And I want to echo the Detective Algren stuff, because what I was sensing by her observing the fact that Detective Algren wasn't looking at her was that she wanted Detective Algren to look at her because she wanted to convince her. She wanted that woman to say, like, to see me, like, I want you to see me. And the fact that she wasn't was like, either I don't have the opportunity to convince Detective Algren, or I'm losing this opportunity to make this connection woman to woman in a way that this woman won't do that to me. You know what I mean? I don't know. Like, I was sensing that little, like, bit of a conflict of, like, wanting to be seen. Whether she is the victim or isn't the victim in the situation, I could tell there was a little bit of female tension there, which I thought was good.
One of the reasons why this works so well is because whether she's Lena, whether she's Joe, whether she's the killer or not, she's still someone who lost a sister and either a nephew or a child. So clearly that's bad. Like, she is in a crisis. She is going through a tough spot no matter who she is. And this is why, like, one of the many reasons why this setup is so powerful. A powerful setup can make all the difference, right? And a lot of people, Emma, pick a powerful setup and they don't deliver. And you did. So again, you should be very, very proud of yourself. Have a celebratory mocktail or cocktail or whatever you like tonight, because you deserve it.
I'm just going to hop in here. So Emma, I want to add as well, the writing was excellent, really, really excellent. There were, however, a few things that can be improved upon. So I'm putting on my creative instructor hat now, and I'm going to share screen so you can see them, but I'm sharing them as well for the listeners, because as writers, we all have these little things that we do that we don't pick up ourselves. And once we become aware of it, even just on 5 pages, you can then search the rest of your documents to find where you've done that particular thing. So I'm just going to point out a few for you here, Emma. Hold on, let me share screen. Alrighty. So have a look here. I have highlighted the times you go with says Detective Algren. There's ones where I've crossed out. The year again was says Detective Garcia. Here says Detective Garcia. Says Detective Garcia, says Detective Garcia. All right. So in those instances, firstly, a lot of these times where you said that, it was actually them asking a question. So you want to mix up your says with asks. And you want to mix up the order of that. So you don't want to always say, says Detective Garcia. You can say Detective Garcia asks or asks Detective Garcia. But even better than that, because you would like to give things that we call action beats rather than dialogue tags, because dialogue tags add very little value. So an example up here is, so is the chamomile all right, Lena? It's all we had, says Detective Garcia, who has just returned from getting me some tea. So instead of doing that, you can say, is the chamomile tea all right, Lena? It's all we had. Detective Garcia has just returned from getting me tea. So we know we have an action beat there without the dialogue tag. So we know that it's Detective Garcia who is saying this particular thing. And it takes out the things like so-and-so says, so-and-so asks, which feels extremely repetitive. And you don't pick it up in your own manuscript. But I promise you that one day when this does get published and when somebody does record the audiobook of it, you're going to hear that in the audiobook, the says, the ask, the says, the ask, and it becomes a little bit painful there. Something else I want to point out that you do is that you tend to put all the dialogue together. You clump all the dialogue together, and then afterwards you put like the action beat or something else. So for example, it's fine, thank you, but I want to go home. I have to be with my husband. Is he here yet? I'll tell you everything. I just need this part to be over. Tears thicken my voice, which is raspy from sobbing. So split that up as opposed to adding the action afterwards, split it up with the dialogue. So it's fine, thank you, but I want to go home. I have to be with my husband. Tears thicken my voice, which is raspy from sobbing. Is he here that I'll tell you everything. I just need this part to be over. And so that's something that happened quite a lot. So it was all the dialogue and then afterwards, who said it? So here again, you know, okay, we are still recording and we're continuing with your statement. If you need another rest, you can let us know. Start whenever you're ready, Mrs. Jansen, blah, 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 blah. So I just cut that up with, if you need another rest, you can let us know. Detective Algren says, without looking up, start whenever you're ready. So you see, if you just split up your dialogue and the dialogue tags, it doesn't feel like those things are being tacked on after that. And it would be fine if you did that once or twice, but have a look here again, consistently done throughout. So it's always nice to put those action beats in the middle of dialogue because it gives the reader something to imagine while they are reading the dialogue as opposed to afterwards. So these are just ticks that I would suggest you go through the document and look out for. It's just going to elevate it. It's just going to polish it and take it to, you know, a whole other level. Okay, so what questions do you now have? Questions, comments for us?
Well, thank you all so much for your comments and your very kind words. And Bianca, for the masterclass in the 5-page edit, which now I'm so excited to get into the whole manuscript and make some changes, and seeing it, you know, highlighted like that just makes it so clear. And I so appreciate you taking the time to do that. And both for Carly and Cece, I'm so thrilled that you liked it. And again, these first 5 pages are not the 5 pages I would have sent you without listening to the podcast. I started in a different place. I started in a different tense. And really listening to tension, start in the right place, have a scene that makes the reader ask questions, really made me take a hard look at what I was doing and make some changes. So I wanted to say thank you so much for that. The curiosity that you both have of like, who is it? I'm glad, because that's, you know, not to be too precious about it. It's twins. They're identical. Like, yes, identity is an issue. And actually, to Carly's earlier point about the title, which I know is kind of a strange title, I just wanted to add a comment on that, which is that cuckoo bees are social parasites. They're nearly identical to regular bees, which allows them to infiltrate and destroy the hive. So they're nature's perfect imposter. And so because this is a story about identical twins, I kind of like the parallels between the human and the animal world, just to give a little explainer for my
yeah.
kind of story.
And does that theme come back, like the natural world, or is there a line about cuckoo bees in the book, or how does that kind of weave itself together?
It does. It comes in much later in the story. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I'm so thrilled to hear your comments. And the point that was made about the repetition, absolutely something I struggle with in the very generous group of family and friends that I've had read drafts of this, including my writing critique partner, Christina, who's read more drafts than I can count at this point. Repetition has always been a problem for me. And I do blame this on being a lawyer and needing to hammer a point to death, which is not a good trait. And so it's definitely something I need to work on. And seeing it highlighted like that is extremely, extremely helpful for me.
Listen, I've published two books and there is still, I've never met a point that I don't want to belabor. So this is probably going to be something that's going to be ongoing for you, because I still find it even now an ongoing issue for me. And that's where your critique partners and you become more aware of it. So you do become, you know, more laser sharp in searching for that. But the critique partners are always such a great resource for cutting that out as well. So I'm sure we're seeing a little bit of repetition, but I'm sure they've cut out a heck of a lot more as well.
Oh, yes. Yes. They're my critique partner, my friend Christina, she's been really good for that. You know, do you need to say this five different ways? Can I do two, maybe three? So yes, definitely something I continue to struggle with.
And Carly, I meant to ask earlier, is the word count okay? Or is it a bit on the short side? That was something I was wanting to ask you.
You know, I don't have a problem with the word count at all. I always say the word count needs to be as long as it takes to tell the story the right way. So I don't have an issue with it. It's on the tighter side, but isn't a problem. Everybody's attention spans right now are like minuscule. You know, there's a lot going on in the world. So I don't mind a shorter novel at all. And it's not short per se. It's like just on the shorter side of average.
Awesome.
And I would just add, I think I pitched it as 74. It's now 75. So I don't, that's not a huge difference, but it's a little bit longer now.
Awesome. Okay, Carly, so you would like to see those pages. You're hoping Emma's going to send that submission to you. Is that right?
That is correct. And I will forward it to my Kindle and read it immediately. So yes, please do.
I would be thrilled to. That makes me so happy.
Yeah. And if you want to take some time and make changes, no pressure, send it, you know, whenever you're ready. But yes, I will read it immediately when I get it.
Do you just want to type in your email address for her, Carly, so that she does have it for that?
Yeah.
All right. So thank you so much, Emma, for joining us. It's incredibly brave to come on. And, you know, it's not just for yourself. It's for the benefit of other writers who learn from the critique that you're getting. And it's a great way to pay it forward for the critique that you've been learning from as well. So we appreciate the huge courage it's taken to come on and chat with us. And I'm so glad that the feedback has been so wonderful and keeping everything crossed for you that this takes off from here. And now we're moving on to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky, though, to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a 1 month language course. Think about the cost of 1 hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
We're beyond excited to announce the first ever The Shit No One Tells You About Writing virtual retreat on the 29th and 30th of January 2022. Who says Januaries have to be dreary and shitty? Not us. We have a jam-packed, amazing schedule, including an hour-long discussion with award-winning number one New York Times bestselling author and publishing phenomenon, Britt Bennett, who is the author of The Vanishing Half and The Mothers, about her journey to publication and her advice for emerging writers. We also have a ton of talks on craft and the business side of writing presented by myself, Carly Waters, and Cece Lira. We will also have world-renowned story expert Lisa Cron, author of Story Genius and Wired for Story. We'll also have Courtney Mom, who's the author of the brilliant Before and After the Book Deal, as well as Valerie Francis, who is an accredited editor when it comes to the Story Grid method. We'll also have Sally Kim, who is the SVP and publisher of Putnam. She's a big-time editor who's edited novels like The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr., which was recently longlisted for the National Book Award, as well as Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid, The Immortalists by Chloe Benjamin, The Gunkle by podcast favorite Stephen Rowley, and Girls Like Us by Christina Elger. And then there's a ton of other things we'll be doing, like breakaway sessions where you can meet other writers or pick our brains with burning questions that you have. You get to speak to all of the presenters after their sessions in Q&As. We have a ton of prizes we'll be giving away and a lot of really exciting content. So if you're interested, please go to my website, biancamurray.com. Go to the page that has courses and retreats and services, and you'll find more information there, as well as details about costing and a link to book. We are really, really looking forward to seeing you at this amazing upcoming event. Before we go to today's guest, this just a reminder, Cece has a course coming up on the 4th of November at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That's called Writing Emotion, How to Weave Emotion into Your Story. Go to Cece's Instagram page to find the link there to book for that course. Today's guest is the best-selling author of The Perfect Nanny, one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 Best Books of the Year, for which she became the first Moroccan woman to win France's most prestigious literary prize. A journalist and frequent commentator on women's and human's rights, she spearheaded a campaign to help Moroccan women speak out as self-declared outlaws against their country's unfair and obsolete laws. She is French President Emmanuel Macron's personal representative for the promotion of French language and culture and was ranked number 2 on Vanity Fair France's annual list of the 50 most influential French people in the world. Born in Morocco in 1981, she now lives in Paris with her French husband and their 2 young children. It's my pleasure to welcome Leila Slimani. Today's guest is a very, very special one. Leila, welcome to the show. It's such an honor to get to chat with you today, and thanks for taking the time for us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Right, we're going to begin today's episode guest segment with a string of lightning round questions that I'm going to fire off at Leila, and she's going to answer for us to give us insight into her process and who she is as a writer. Okay, first question, are you a plotter or a pantser?
A plotter, I think. You mean, do I give more importance to the plot? This is what you mean.
So upfront, do you kind of plot everything out before you begin writing, or do you have a general idea and you write and you see where it goes?
I would say both. The truth is I have a plot, and I have also some scenes that I know that I can see. I have visions and I write those scenes, and I try at the end to structure all this to make a good plot. It's a mix of both, I think. It would be impossible for me not to have the plot at the beginning and not also to follow my intuition and to follow my visions when I write.
Wonderful. So it's a hybrid. Okay. So do you write on computer or in longhand in notebooks?
I write on computer, but I always have a notebook with me to write some ideas, some sentences I can hear in the street or things I can read in the newspaper or see on TV. So my notebook is always with me for inspiration, but when I write on my computer.
Wonderful. Do you like writing in private or in public?
Oh, in private, always. It's absolutely impossible for me to write in public in a cafe or in a restaurant. I couldn't imagine that.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I'm easily distracted. So then maybe this answers the next question. Do you write in silence or to music?
Silence, absolutely, because I need to hear the music of my own sentences, of my own language. And it's very important for me. So when I write, then I read out loud what I just wrote. And it's very important for me to hear this music. So if I was listening to music, I would probably be, it would be poisoned. It would be a problem for me. So impossible to listen to music.
I love hearing that, because we often say to our emerging writers, read your work aloud. It's incredibly, incredibly important to hear it, not just to see it on the page. Do you share your work while you're drafting it, or do you wait until the end when it's finished?
No, I share my work with my publisher while I'm writing. After the first 50 or 80 pages, I send them to him and I wait for his reaction. And very often it helps me, because he can tell me, okay, I like that, but you should do more on this character. He gives me a lot of ideas, and we've always worked like this. I'm always in a dialogue with him.
And do you share your work with your agent as well, or is it just your editor?
No, I don't have an agent. I work completely alone, me and my editor.
Okay, so what's your favorite point of view to write in? First person or third person?
Third person. I just wrote one book first person, but always third person. And I love to write through the point of view of one of my characters.
All right, so sort of third person close then. Do you prefer past or present tense, or don't you have a preference?
Difficult question, tough question. I like the present, and in my first two books were at the present. And in a certain way, I think it's easiest to write in the present. There's something more clinical, more dry, more rough when you write in the present. But I love also the lyrical style that you can find when you write in the past. So I love both, I think.
Yeah, so obviously it just depends on which suits that particular story.
Exactly.
Do you think prologues are awesome, or do you think prologues are cheating?
I don't really have a point of view. I think that if a prologue is well written and you feel it's necessary to write it, it can be beautiful. The only thing is it has to be necessary. It's not. It has not to be artificial. You know, it has to be very authentic and sincere. So no, I don't really have a point of view. If it's beautiful, if it's good, it's good.
Yeah. We say to our emerging writers that many of them tend to put on a prologue as a band-aid because they feel that the opening chapter hasn't done the heavy lifting that it needs to do. sometimes they tend to fall back on prologues to kind of make up for that.
That would be a very bad idea, because when you're a writer, you don't have to explain too much. You don't have to justify yourself or be afraid of, will people understand or not understand? I think at the moment you begin to write, you must accept the, first of all, you must think that reader is clever, the reader is smart, the reader will understand a lot of things, and you don't have to explain everything to him. He's absolutely able to understand what you're trying to do. So never justify your work and never try to explain everything, because it will ruin a book.
Do you prefer drafting or do you prefer revising?
I prefer revising. Drafting, you have to do it, but it's difficult. It's very difficult. So I think that the moment you arrive to revising means that your book exists and you did something and you have a real work to work on. So it's better. It's less frustrating, I think.
Yeah. Are you a big fan of adverbs and adjectives, or do you try and cut them all out?
When I write a book like The Perfect Nanny, when it's a book in the present, a sort of thriller, I hate adverbs and adjectives because it doesn't suit with my subject. When I write a book like The Country of Others, that is a historical book, a familial saga, I need an adjective, but I don't like adverbs. I try to avoid them as much as I can.
Right. And for our listeners, this goes back to what we're always saying. If you use a really well-chosen verb, you don't need the adverbs to help
Absolutely.
Do the heavy lifting. Right. Do you love or hate the copy editing part of the process?
No, I love that. I love that. And I love every part of the process, because you know, it's like when you're having a child, you like the first semester and you like the second one, and even if the end is difficult and you feel heavy and you just want to give birth and to meet your baby, at the end when you think of it, you like it, you like the third semester too. So I love every part of the process, because you need that. You need to do whatever you can and to put all your energy for your book to be the best you can write.
Wonderful. What generally comes to you first, character or plot?
Character. Character always first. And the truth is that when the character begins to exist, they tell me what to do. They tell me what to write. You have to listen to them. They have a real life. They have emotions. And sometimes I even fight with them. Sometimes I don't agree with what they want to do and how they want to act. And there is this very beautiful anecdote about Tolstoy saying to his publisher, I can't write because Anna Karenina has left and I'm waiting for her to come back. And the publisher at that time, he didn't understand that, but I think it's absolutely true. Sometimes they are here and they are telling us what to do, and sometimes they leave and we just have to wait them to come back.
Wonderful. What do you prefer, the three-act structure, or do you prefer using more action beats like in something like Save the Cat, for example?
Yeah, I prefer that to Save the Cat. I love I'm not the three parts, and I don't like something that is too structured. I love to invent something that is hybrid, that is weird, that is gray. I don't love it. I don't like when it's too structured and when you can see exactly how it's done.
Right. What do you prefer writing, dialogue or description?
Oh, I don't like to write dialogues at all. I think it's very difficult to write good dialogue, and I'm not good at that. And there are very few dialogues in my books. And I think that when you know you're not good at, don't do it. If you know it's not going to be good, try another way to have the conversation between your characters. At the beginning, I remember I was speaking with my publisher and he said, you don't have the gift for dialogue. Find something else. and that's what I did. And I'm very admirative of writers who can write good dialogues. It's very difficult.
That was actually going to be a question I was going to ask you later, how little dialogue there is in the novel. So I was actually going to ask you specifically about that. So you've actually answered for that for us up front. And then, are you a fan of backstory or do you avoid it at all costs?
No, you have to explain to me what you mean by backstories.
So in terms of a character's history, is it a case of you know it, but you don't put it on the page? Or is it a case of you believe everything that came before that's relevant needs to be there on the page for the reader to have access to?
Oh, no, I'm not a fan of backstories. I think that maybe the most important in a novel is what you don't write. Maybe even more important than what you write. I think that ellipse, what we call ellipse in French, I don't know in English how you say, is very, very important. It's very important not to say everything, because in those spaces, you will leave a possibility for the reader to work on his own imagination and to imagine what happened before. And you put certain freedom, you give freedom to the reader in the novel. I don't like the idea of telling everything and understanding everything, explaining everything. A novel is also about silence and about ellipse.
Yeah, right. So your new novel, In the Country of Others, is modeled on your grandmother's immigration from France to Morocco amid Morocco's fight for independence. Could you tell us a bit more about that as an inspiration? I've read some of the interviews you've done, and your grandmother sounds like an incredibly fascinating woman.
Yes, she was. She was, and she had a fantastic personality. She was very free and very funny, and she was a great storyteller. And I think that she was my inspiration as a woman, as a writer too. And I wanted to give a tribute to that, to her sense of telling stories, but also I wanted to the reader to feel what I felt when I was a child, hearing the stories she told me about the war, about how she met my grandfather. It was so fascinating. It was so different, so original, that I really wanted to explore that and to try to convey this emotion.
She also wrote a memoir, didn't she? Did that help you in terms of the writing of this novel? Was that something you referred to a lot? I know you've said that you firmly believe that this is fiction and you've entirely fictionalized it, but in terms of your research process?
Yes, it helped me a little bit, even if the memoir of my grandmother is more about her own family and about the Alsace at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. So it gave me the backstory we were talking about before, and it helped me understand what it was to be an Alsacian girl in the 40s. But I didn't use a lot of information from that. And the information in the book, I knew it because she told me in person, and she told me so many stories that I didn't really need to read the memoir to know them.
Wonderful. So you've said in an interview that for inspiration, you turned to American Western movies and the novels of William Faulkner, Carson McCullers, and Flannery O'Connor. You said there is a lot Moroccans can identify with in Southern literature, from the relationship to nature, at once hostile and sensual, to racial tensions, even if they're not the same as in the United States. And you said you wanted to build your own Alabama. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I've always been a huge fan of the literature of the South of America, and I've always been fascinated and very interested in the story of this part of the U.S. because, of course, of the story of slavery, segregation, and the relationship to nature. When I was beginning my book, I thought, okay, it's not because I write about Morocco that I can't use this literature that inspired me so much and that moved me so much. And I thought that, for instance, in a novel like Gone with the Wind, that has nothing to do with my own life or my own cultural tradition. At the same time, there are a lot of things I can identify myself to that I can understand. Tension between races, tension between classes, the relationship that women can have with the war, and all that, and to the farm also, to the property, like in Gone with the Wind. So I think it's always interesting to use references that can seem very far away to describe a situation, because it gives you a certain sense of universality.
Absolutely. When I was writing my debut novel, which was based on growing up in apartheid South Africa and pretty much being brainwashed as a white child to be racist, books that guided me in that writing of that were books that were American, things like The Secret Life of Bees, etc. And although the American experience was so different, there were those commonalities in terms of theme. So yeah, I can completely relate to that. So your prose has been described as unsparing. Now, the hardest part for emerging writers is to find their distinctive voice and their distinctive style. Could you tell us, you know, how you went about finding that voice? Was it always your voice from being a young writer? Is it something that you've grown into?
It's very difficult to say. I would say that it's a mix of work, a lot of work, writing all the time, reading a lot also. It's very important to read all the time and to be interested in the style of other writers. So it's a mix of work, and also one day you find the ability to be in front of your computer and to feel completely free and to feel completely sincere. And you stop thinking about what people are going to think, how readers are going to react, how media are going to react. You think only about your book and about a certain truth, a certain sincerity that you want to put in your work. And I think that's the moment when you find your style and when you find your voice. You have to try to dig very deeply inside yourself and listen to what you really have to say, not to say to seduce or to please or to be the best writer in the world, but just to say something that matters to you.
Yeah, that definitely resonates. You know, for younger writers today, you started writing very young. And when I read articles about younger authors, people like Zadie Smith, I mean, I remember reading White Teeth and I absolutely adored that novel. And Zadie Smith has said in subsequent interviews that when she reads that book, she's very embarrassed by it compared to her newer novels. And I struggle with that because I must be honest, I preferred her earlier work to her later work. So is that something that you ever experience yourself, going back to your earlier work?
I never think about my work. I never analyze my work. When something is finished, it's finished, and I do something else. And that's the only thing I can do. I think it's very dangerous for a writer to think too much about himself. I'm not very interested in myself. I write my stories, and then I begin another one. I want to read so many books that I don't have time to reread my own. So I want to read books from other people. So I don't really have any idea or any point of view of my own work. I think that other people can do it better than me.
Yeah, well, like, you know, everyone's a critic, so
yeah.
Right, so when we give emerging writers advice, you know, we'll give them sort of rules about writing, about exposition versus dramatization, in terms of when you begin with your opening pages, you should anchor the reader in that particular scene, no backstory, no exposition, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the guidelines we give them as they begin writing. But someone of your caliber, you get to the point where you have mastered those rules so well that you transcend them. And so you're able to be breaking those rules. So most young novelists, you know, will say to them, have dramatized scenes, have the dialogue in there, etc. Show everything as it unfolds rather than telling us about it. Your novel is more the exposition than the dramatization. And as well, what I found fascinating is that your opening page, they're visiting the farm, it's in 1947. And then in the very next paragraph, you go back in 1935 after years spent working as a translator. And then you give us some backstory, and then you go to 1939 as well. And then on the next page, you bring us back to 1947. Could you give us like some advice to writers in terms of how much of the rules do they need to pay attention to? How much can they just completely ignore and find their own way into a novel?
You know, I think that in France, we have a very different vision of what you call the rules. In France, no writer would ever tell you about the rules, about exposition, structure, how you should do. I'm quite different because I think that, for instance, in France, people don't understand the creative writing in the US. They say, oh, you know, if you're a writer, you're a writer. You're born a writer and you will be able to do it and you have nothing to learn. And I don't believe in that. I think you can learn a lot of things. But at the same time, I think also that it's very important to trust the reader, not to think, oh, no, I can't do that because he won't understand, or it's too complicated, or he will feel lost. I think that if you have enough confidence in yourself and in the reader, if you take his hand and you're like, I'm going to tell you a story, just listen to me, just be quiet and attentive, and you will see, you will understand everything. I try to do exactly as my mother and my grandmother was doing when I was a child, and they were telling these stories before I sleep. You know, children, they can understand very complex stories. And you have to think of that, the power of telling just a story when, you know, out loud, you tell a story to someone. So I always imagine that I have someone in front of me, a child or anyone, and I'm telling him the story. And the only thing that I want, the only thing that I need is for him to understand that and not to feel lost in my plot and with the characters. So yes, I have a lot of confidence in the reader.
Yeah, and there's so much to be said for the oral tradition as well when it comes to...
Absolutely, it's very important to be, and I read a lot of fairy tales, I read a lot of myths. It's a great inspiration for me. I think it's very important to reread the stories of when we were children, because the oral tradition is so strong when it comes to telling a story and building a structure like this that seems so easy, so natural. So yeah, it's a great source of inspiration.
You must be someone people must love having at dinner parties, because you must be a wonderful storyteller at dinner parties as well. You spoke about, you know, writing in France versus writing in North America. So that takes me to my next question. You know, can you speak about writing in French and then seeing your work translated into English? So many of our listeners speak English as a second language, and yet they feel like they have to write in it for whatever reason, accessibility, or maybe they can't find publishers in the languages in which they're writing. Can you speak a bit about that?
I couldn't imagine writing in another language than French. I think that the relationship that you have with the language you write in is so important. It's so question of, I don't know how to say it, comes from your gut. It's you have to write with the language you dream in, with the language from your childhood, with the language you learn the first word with. I can't imagine writing in English or in another language. I love French language. I could hear it for hours, and I love to read poems and to hear songs in French. I think it's very, very important to have an emotional, to have an instinctive relationship with the language you're writing in. And at the same time, I love working with my translator. My English translator, Sam Taylor, is so gifted, and he's a wonderful translator. And I learn a lot of things working with him about my own style, but also about the English language. It's wonderful, the work you can do with a translator.
Yeah, so perhaps advice then to our listeners out there is, instead of trying to do your first draft, you know, in English, if you're wanting to be published in English, perhaps to write that in the language, like Leila says, that you dream in, that you think in, that comes to you so instinctively.
I think so.
Yeah, because I feel like if you're translating your own work, as if you're thinking in one language and then you're writing in another language, there's that barrier immediately, because you're constantly not necessarily censoring yourself, but you're having to translate yourself. And there's so many words in different languages that English just doesn't have a word for.
Yeah, and it's important to be proud of your language, to be proud of the world you know, and of the world you learn when you were a child. I think that this, it's not pride, it's the fact that you sort of recognition of the beauty of a language. I feel it's sad that you renounce writing the language that is yours for another one because it sells better. It's evident in terms of what it's saying about our world and about the global literature. I think it's very sad.
Yeah. A question I wanted to ask you, but I think I've just from chatting with you, I think I do know the answer to this, is, has it become harder as you've had acclaim, as you've had won awards, as you've been on bestseller lists, etc.? Do you feel more pressure later on with the writing than what you did before after each success? Or is that not something that you concern yourself with? You just write.
No, I don't feel more pressure, but I feel afraid. I think that success is not a good friend for a writer. And I think that celebrity is not good for a writer. A writer should always stay hidden and should always stay invisible in his own bubble. I'm always afraid to lose my honesty and to lose my soul, my emotions. I'm afraid to be poisoned by commentators and what people are expecting from me. Because what you have, the only thing that you need, your only tool when you're a writer, is your heart, your emotion, your soul. If you're not pure anymore, if you try to do things just because you need a success or because you want to please, there's no point writing if you write like that. And when you read the diaries of great writers like Steinbeck or Hemingway or writers like that, they all have a very mixed or ambiguous feeling about success. They all say, yeah, it's beautiful to have success, but at the same time, even Albert Camus, I'm so afraid not to be the man I used to be before. I don't want to change. And I think it's something very important to preserve yourself. And when you write, to be in a fortress, in a bubble, and not to be influenced by what's happening outside.
Right. And you champion women a lot, Leila, and these writers you've all just mentioned are obviously male writers, and something that women writers struggle with a lot is imposter syndrome. It's this, who am I to be writing this? Why do I have something to say that the world should hear? Why is my perspective important? What can you say to our women listeners who struggle with that when it comes to writing?
I think that's any writer would feel this imposter syndrome, because when you have read Proust and Virginia Woolf and Toni Morrison, you're like, okay, what's the point in writing? They wrote so beautiful book. I'm just going to write another book. And what's the point? Every day when you go to your office and you're in front of your computer, you ask yourself, what's the point? So I felt that all my life, and I'm sure I'm going to feel it for the rest of my life. But that's not a problem. If you feel the urge to write, if you feel that you have something to say, just say it. Don't try to analyze, to understand. Don't try to justify what you're doing. There is no justification in writing or dancing or singing. We do it because it's beautiful. We do it because we can create beauty and emotion, and we can build bridge between people. That's the only thing that matters. Tell your story and don't think about why, how do I have the right. If there is a place where you don't have to justify yourself, it's art. So do it, just do it.
Yeah, and I think the lesson there for us in that is, don't think you're going to overcome the imposter syndrome, and don't think you're going to get away from it. Just write despite it, because it is always going to be there. Because I think many of our listeners feel, well, once I publish my first novel, I'll feel more confident and I'll feel like I've made it, etc. But like you say, it's always going to be there. And the stakes, I think, just keep getting upped with each bit of success you have. So I think instead of it getting easier, I think it perhaps gets harder, but it's just writing despite that. Yeah.
And I think it would be a very bad thing and a bad signal to feel too much confident and to say, okay, now I'm a writer and I know what I'm doing and I'm going to write a masterpiece. No one feels that. I don't believe in that. And I think that if you feel that, it's not a good thing. You should do something else.
And that's it for today's episode. If you have any questions about writing or publishing, please email me at theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com. And I'll do my best to get them answered for you. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists, while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists, while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on.